Tonight's the 34th anniversary of John Fung's passing. He was a person who, like the poet has said, contained multitudes. I had a dream about him one time, very early on in my time with him. He was wearing a cowboy hat. And then he went into this room and came out and was wearing another hat. Then he went back into the room, came out with another hat. I peeked into the room. It was a closet full of all kinds of hats. And the dream seemed to have to do with the fact that he could play many roles. This was at a time they were preparing for a get-in. And he was in charge of the construction of the booths. They didn't have tents the way we have here. They would make booths out of bamboo and palm fronds. He was skilled in all kinds of ways. But he was also a person of many personalities. He could be harsh. He could be gentle. There were times when he would explain things in great detail, and other times he wouldn't explain things at all. There's that passage in a John Lee's autobiography where he talks about being with the John Mun. And his duty was to arrange things in John Mun's room after the meal. And then the John Mun would go in and complain to a John Lee that things were not put in the right places, but he would never tell him where the right places were. When John Lee solved the problem, John Mun lived in a hut that had banana leaf walls, and so he poked a hole in the wall. So after he'd arranged the room, he went out and peeked through the hole. And when John Mun went in, looked left, looked right, arranged this, arranged that, rearranged this, rearranged that. So John Lee made a mental note of where everything was supposed to be. And the next day he went in and arranged things as he'd remembered, went back and looked through the hole again. And John Mun went into the room. He probably knew where John Lee was looking. He looked left, right, nothing was out of place. He sat down and did his chants. Well, that's the way John Fung was with me. I was in charge of arranging things in his hut. He would never tell me where the right places were. If something was in the wrong place, somebody would just pick it up and throw it. Not at me, but just throw it. So I had to notice, when he placed things, where did he place them? Other times he would explain things in great detail. Part of the forest tradition, and it's an old Thai tradition in general, that you try to train people to be observant by not explaining everything all the time. Some things you explain, some things you leave it up to the student to figure out. On the basic assumption that the John does something, he has a reason. I know a lot of Western monks who studied in Thailand and came back, and their conclusion was, well, the Ajahns did things simply because they were Thai. Well, that's the way Thais do things. Which meant, of course, that as a Westerner, you were not bound to do things that way. But I discovered if I assumed that Ajahn Fung had reasons for doing things, I could find lots of good reasons. It made me think back on my own actions. And his way of doing things then became lessons. He was extremely loyal to John Lee. He had one Ajahn in his life. He did study at one point with Ajahn Mun, but he never felt quite comfortable with Ajahn Mun. He stuck with Ajahn Lee until the end of Ajahn Lee's life, stayed on, made sure everything was arranged for the funeral, and then went off. He was very independent. Loyal, but independent at the same time. As you like to say, we're nobody's servant. Nobody hired us to be born. Nobody hired us to practice. So don't let people order us around. There was one time when I came across some old papers of his. I was sorting through his things and throwing out things that need to be thrown out. Came across some papers where he'd been practicing signing his name. He'd been given an ecclesiastical rank, a prakru, which is below that of a jakun. And when you get a rank like that, you get a new name. And so he'd been practicing signing his new name. So I asked him, Tenpo, when are you going to become a jakun with the same name? He said, oh, that kind of stuff is no good at all. You become a jakun and rich and famous people come in to the monastery to check you out. And then they start ordering you around. Then he told the story of what had happened in Bangkok just a few weeks earlier. There was a woman who was famous for raising support for the forest tradition. She was head of a Buddhist organization in one of the large government monopolies in Bangkok. And the organization would print books, raise money for different monasteries. And some of Ajahn Fung's students kept hoping that, you know, she would find out about us and raise money for us. And someone had finally prevailed on her to come and visit Ajahn Fung in Bangkok. And she told him that she was interested in printing some English Dharma books, and she'd heard there were some English translations of Ajahn Lee. At that point we had, what, Keeping the Breath in Mind, Frames of Reference, Craft of the Heart. And so he gave her copies, a copy of each, and said, you can print whichever one you like. So she took them. And a week later she came back and said, that's not what I want. I want his autobiography. Now, I had already translated the autobiography. It hadn't been printed. Ajahn Fung's policy was that you lead with the Dharma, but not with autobiographies. And so he told her, sorry, I can't help you. And she never came back. And that was his purpose. He didn't want people ordering things around in the monastery. I said he was extremely independent, but he also was very loyal and also had a very strong sense of duty. He was very strict about the vinaya. And he had very clear standards about what was proper and what was not proper, which made it very easy to live with him. Once you got a sense of what his standards were, you could stick by them. There were times when I was getting criticized by some of the lay people for holding to Ajahn Fung's standards. They went and complained. And I could always depend on him. If I was holding by his standards, he wasn't going to criticize me. No matter how influential or how large a role the lay people might have played in the monastery, I came to take that for granted. And then after he passed away and had to deal with the monk who was appointed as acting abbot, I began to realize how special Ajahn Fung was. Because that monk, whatever wealthy lay person came in with some project for the monastery, he would just go along with them, no matter how good it was for the monastery or not. So it's good to think about the standards of the Ajahns of the past, the real Ajahns. And this way Ajahn Fung was typical of the really great Ajahns, in that he's, as I said, strong sense of duty. Strong loyalty to his teacher, but a very strong independent streak, an interesting combination. But a combination that works well as you practice. Because you will have to be independent. Because what he was teaching me, with not telling me where things were supposed to be, was to be independent, to use my own powers of observation. His policy also was never to praise his students, except in cases where he felt a particular student wouldn't be making any further progress than that. I began to realize if I heard him praise somebody, that was a sign that was as far as that person was going to go. If he felt there was room for improvement, he'd keep finding ways to criticize you. I was his attendant. I was always trying to please him, but I never got any indication from him, any direct verbal indication. His attitude was, as a student, you should want to study. You shouldn't want to have things handed to you. You should take the initiative to figure things out. And learn how to take criticism in the spirit with which it's given, which is, here's the area where you need improvement. And if you improve, you're going to be better off. You're not practicing to please somebody else. You're practicing because you have suffering in your heart. The teacher's there to offer you advice on how to get rid of that suffering. That should be your motivation. Someone once came to the monastery and noticed that there was a Western monk there. So I asked John Fung, how is it that Westerners can ordain? And his response was, don't Westerners have hearts? Can't they suffer too? So I think that was what pulled me to a John Fung to begin with. It was a strong sense that he cared about my training. He saw that I was suffering. He sympathized. But his sympathy was not the sort of sympathy of soft words. It was a sympathy of, this is what you need to do. And if you're motivated, okay, you'll do it. After he died, they created a museum of his effects. I was in charge of arranging things for it. And one of the things we arranged in there was his robe. I found one of his robes that he had darned. And I wanted to show that he took good care of his things. So I folded it up and placed it in the cabinet, showing the spot that was darned. And a week or two after we'd placed it in there, someone came running down. They said, there's something on the robe. So I went up and looked in the cabinet, and it looked like this kind of diamond dust on the robe. And my first reaction was it was mold. And I said, how did mold get on there? Because we ironed the robe properly and everything. Everybody else was assuming that his sweat had turned into relics. And word got out. And every now and then we'd have people come and visit the monastery to see the robe. One group in particular stands out. They were from the education ministry. They came in this large van. I was staying in the hut at the foot of the hill, and they came up and they said, I understand that John Fung's robe shows his relics. Can we see it? I said, what's up on the top of the hill in his mausoleum? So they went up. They came back down again. Yes. Since he passed away, any other things that were amazing happened around to John Fung? And I said, well, I think it's pretty amazing that people would drive all the way out from Bangkok to look at a piece of cloth. He said, no, that's not what we meant. How about when he was alive? Anything amazing? And so what I thought was amazing was that even though he was Thai and I was a Westerner, my time with him, I never had the feeling that that was a barrier between us. The communication was heart to heart, even though I had to learn Thai ways of doing things still. I had a strong sense that he didn't treat me simply as a Westerner, he treated me as a human being. And I tried to reciprocate, and I said, that I thought was amazing, it's very hard to find. That kind of communication. No, that's not what we meant, they said. So I took pity on them and handed out some amulets, and they went home. But there was that quality about John Fung. He always seemed to stand outside of Thai culture a little bit. As I said, he was very independent. And because he was something of an outsider, and I was something of an outsider. I think that's where we're connected. And as always, when we think about the good qualities of people who passed away, the question always is, how can we develop some of their good qualities? Such as a strong sense of duty. And that kind of independence, that's willing to figure things out. Because this is a practice where we're not just sitting here accepting things as they come. We've got to figure out. The mind is suffering. It's creating its own suffering, even though it wants happiness. Why? How? What can we do? We're happy to accept help from those who have found a reliable way to the end of suffering. But as they all point out, the work is up to us. So you end up having to do what I did, even if it was just something as simple as learning where the right places were. You try things out, and then you look, see what the reaction is. You try something else. You're not so afraid to make a mistake that you don't try. You've got to try. The mistake comes, and as John Fungroy said, mistakes can always be rectified if you're willing to look, willing to admit that they're mistakes, and look inside yourself for what went wrong. So become responsible, you become accountable. And that's how an independent streak becomes not just willfulness and stubbornness, but it becomes an asset in doing your duty. Are you trying to comprehend suffering, abandon its cause, develop the path so you can realize the end of suffering? That's what we're here for. That should be your motivating force. Some of the things get explained or don't get explained. You try to figure them out. And that way, that riddle of the heart. Why does the heart create suffering even though it wants happiness? Has a chance of getting solved.